Welcome to Globally Speaking, a podcast dedicated to unlocking global understanding. Join us as we engage with experts and innovators who are reshaping the way we connect with global audiences. Whether seeking to refine your approach, wanting to expand your understanding of AI and its role in transcending global communication barriers, or just curious about the intricacies of global content, this podcast promises to enlighten and inspire.
Welcome to Globally Speaking. I'm Michael Wayne. I'm the head of media and entertainment at RWS. I'm joined with my friend Justin Bodine, who is the founder and CEO of Adapt. We're excited to talk about AI dubbing today. So let's get started. Justin, Adapt. Give us a couple seconds on what Adapt is. And obviously your background is really interesting. You've been in the localization space, AI dubbing space, or dubbing space in general for many, many years. I'm fairly new to the space, having just been an advisor at Papercup and joining RWS last year. So I'm excited for us to kind of get into our perspectives on localization and AI dubbing, but give us a little background on you and Adapt.
Yeah, awesome. Michael, great. Thanks for having me here. Excited to be on the podcast with you. Adapt is just a toddler. It's nearly 2 years old, in its infancy still. I, on the other hand, as you can see by my hairline that doesn't exist, I've been around a little bit longer, 20 years in the industry. Started at General Electric as a mechanical engineer, got rerouted to NBC and never left media, and did 12 years at NBC Universal, and then got to work at great storied companies like Deluxe, which is known for post-production and traditional localization with voice actors and dubbing directors and all of that. And even though I'm any kind of engineer by nature, I fell in love with the magic of you're recreating a story when you're dubbing it. But a few years ago, all these AI tools started coming out, and I really felt like everything was going to change related to localization. I wanted to be a part of that change. And I also felt that startups would have an edge. And maybe we could debate that on today's podcast, but would have an edge in this change. And we founded Adapt on the principle of taking all these new AI tools and combining them with localization experts by language that we call cultural ambassadors. And so Adapt is founded on this principle of taking all this new tech, combining it with traditional experts, and hopefully creating something really valuable to the industry. We will see. I guess I'll throw it back to you, right? We got to meet on your Papercup journey, maybe frenemies that have become true friends. Tell us about yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background, Michael.
Yeah, for sure. So Papercup was an AI dubbing startup that was founded in London probably about 6-7 years ago by a guy named Jesse Sheeman. He was the founder. He's an American guy actually living in London. And I met him through a mutual friend about 5.5 years ago. At that time, I was running a startup that I had been running for many, many years. That was a digital studio called Kin. And I was really interested in mentoring young entrepreneurs, having been a young entrepreneur myself many, many moons ago. And I thought, 5.5 years ago, meeting an AI startup founder was sort of like remarkable, right? AI wasn't what it is today. This is pre-ChatGPT. It was like it struck me as almost like a research project more than anything. And so I started advising the company. And then got really involved over many, many years and was a part of the whole process of the company getting acquired by RWS. And as someone who'd been in the content space for pretty much my whole career, I was really interested in kind of the intellectual challenge of trying to figure out how AI would get integrated into the media and entertainment workflow. And so RWS had a new CEO, a guy named Ben, who had come from 15 years of working at YouTube, which was very familiar to me, having worked with YouTube for many, many years. And I just like this idea, again, of trying to figure out how AI would really change the media and entertainment space. Now, I think what's interesting is, I think one of the questions, fundamental questions, and I kind of want to get back to Adapt, is how will either fundamental or foundational technology be used? How will companies like Adapt and RWS either build or buy technology or orchestrate technology. And I think that's, we're all trying to figure this out. We obviously at RWS felt like it was important to buy technology. Papercup is a technology, you know, is an underlying technology. It's not a foundational model, but they had invested in building models and tools and things like that. Voices, I would say, synthetic voices. Adapt, and tell me if I'm wrong, has taken the approach of, hey, we don't need to actually own voices or own the underlying technology, although I think you have some technology at Adapt. You prefer to orchestrate the best in class technology. And so I'm kind of curious, like, where does it, in your mind, is that inevitable that basically the big tech guys will essentially own the underlying technology and it's for the rest of us to be kind of expert in orchestrating and being sort of the customer facing interface for that? Or how do you think of it long term?
I think so. I mean, to your point, I think our bet at Adapt was there are some really brilliant data scientists, you know, ML engineers, and they're gonna build what I would say the first layer of the layer cake of AI dubbing. Yeah, they're gonna build these foundational models. And then you're gonna have maybe some people come along and do something kind of neat with it from a technology standpoint. Maybe they'll make it sing, you know, maybe they'll do a better voice library. So maybe you'll have something on top of that foundational model. And then you're gonna have this control, what I call the control layer, where you're gonna have that layer where the linguist or the creative is going to go into something that looks like Pro Tools and is going to start typing out and generating voices, and they're calling these different models. And so I think there's a control layer to layer cake, and then there's an orchestration layer, which is like, hey, you need to give me your media. I'm going to take your media. I'm going to take your script. I'm going to take your M&E. I'm going to take your dialogue stems. I'm going to mix it all up, put it in this control layer, and then push something out to the end. And then at the very top of this cake that I'm baking right now is to me the service layer. And I think that one's important too. And I think a lot of people are worried about that layer going away. And I don't think so. Like I think the humans that'll work with the customers, define the creative aspects and guideline for how this should be translated or dubbed, the humans that will craft the voices, the humans that will do the mix are going to stay on the top of this layer cake. That part of the cake is not going away. And so our bet at Adapt is we'll take the first three layers of the cake and we'll let the other two, you know, other people invest in the bottom two. That's the bet. And
I think I agree with you. I think maybe another perspective on it is, do we think that Gemini and or Google and Meta and OpenAI and let's even throw 11 Labs in there will build a really expert linguist layer / customer service layer / subject matter expert layer on top of their technology? I would say history says that technology companies usually like staying as close to the technology and just doubling and tripling down on the technology part. And that once it kind of gets into maybe more specialized categories or more human stuff, they kind of are like, we like our tech. Is that fair?
I think so. Yeah. My answer to your question is no. I don't see them doing that. I don't think they will. If they did, we'd see a closed captioning service offering from Google instead of just a button to turn on your closed captions, right? And further, I think there's a lot of tech in that cake that may not be $1 billion foundational models or even $20-30 million voice models, but are sort of $1-2 million investments in technology that move that orchestrate it a little bit better. And I think that's a sweet spot for, you know, Adapt to play, but RWS and a lot of people who know localization to play. That would be my guidance to our entire industry if they asked, would be to say, you know, there's a lot of layers to this cake. Let's all pick one and work together.
Don't you get a little freaked out though when you open up YouTube and go to multilingual audio, or you open up Instagram and you see, you know, Hindi as a selection, you know, as sort of like you, in the audio track drop down, you're like, oh my God, these guys though. Like, I agree with you that there's room for Adapt and room for RWS and room for other players kind of at the top layers of the cake. But don't you get a little freaked out when you see how fast some of this technology is evolving at the foundational level? Or maybe not.
Yes, probably because I've invested so much personally into this journey. So yes, I'm always a little freaked out as a founder. You probably know that better than I do, what that journey's like. But it's funny. I've been doing this a lot. That the inflection, at least in voice AI, and this Apple disclosure, you guys could put the disclosure here that, you know, Justin's opinion only. But I think in voice AI, we had this massive inflection point where suddenly voices went from sounding super robotic to pretty darn human, and you could clone voices. And now I think the curve is starting to dip. And it's funny because I've been, you know, doing a lot, this motion with my team a lot.
Yeah.
You know, we're approaching infinity. And I think it was Ben Affleck on the Joe Rogan show who did this, but I don't, he wasn't talking about voice specifically. But I think he was talking about AI, and he was like, you know, it's starting, you know, the big dramatic ChatGPT moment is starting to curve down, I think, a little bit. And as we approach that infinity line of, you know, if we're approaching the sort of premium video quality line, I think that you start to get that bend, and there's a lot of effort to jump up to the quality line. That's my opinion on it, and there's a lot to do there.
I think you're right. I think he was saying that going from ChatGPT 4 to 5 was kind of a big leap, and now to get the same leap, you need 4 times as much GPU power, 4 times as much money. Like, it's getting more exponential to get incremental improvements from a cost standpoint and from a compute standpoint. So what does that mean, though, to our business? That are we stuck at the moment now with just the quality we're getting in AI dubbing is going to be the quality, and it's up to the market to adapt? Or are there ways using humans and using tools to kind of bridge that last, I don't know what you want to call it, that last mile, the last quality mile with a pretty, I would say, discerning media and entertainment clients?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a mix. You know, there was a VC who said to me, I thought it was really good, there's no doubt that we're going to spend more money on investing faster chips, and there's no doubt that money is being spent to make better models. So things will get better. And then I think us in this localization niche also believe that there's tips and tricks to be learned, and there's good ways to do this stuff, and that the workflow and the process, and maybe how often you're going to grab your microphone versus try to type it out, will impact the quality. And so I think it'll be a mix. And so, you know, if we're at, you know, and I'll ask your opinion of where you think AI dubbing is versus traditional, but if we're at a 7 today, I think in a year we'll be at an 8 on a 1 to 10 scale. But I mean, you obviously, you know, you aligned with Papercup, and I just go back. Papercup, when people told me that Papercup started in 2017, 2018, I was just shocked, right? Like, in 2017, 2018, I would have told you no way. I would have told you we're 20 years away from voices being replicated by a machine. Like, no way is that going to happen. And yet Papercup was doing it. So I guess I'd love to hear your perspective on, you know, quality. Just you guys were one of the pioneers. Certainly Jesse was, and you joined them.
For sure. I think that there are a lot of ways to look at Papercup. One is quality. We weren't competing in the same market as 11 Labs. And for those who don't know 11 Labs, I would say 11 Labs is sort of the de facto winner in the creator economy in terms of being able to provide a self-serve, pretty broad-based voice library and tooling for a creator. Now, we kind of looked at it more as an enterprise, and I think that you are too, looking at it more as an enterprise solution as opposed to a creator solution, although I know you're working with creators and we can talk about that. But so I think quality was always really important to us, and really pushing the boundaries of tone, you know, the voices being as emotive as possible, prosody, all of these things that go to making sort of voices good. I also think there was an ethics thing with Paper Cup, and I'd love to hear kind of your thoughts on just AI and ethics in general, where we wanted to source our voices ethically. We wanted to compensate voice actors ethically. And so I still think that's, you know, from an RWS standpoint, now that we own Paper Cup, is still something that we want to lean into and are leaning into it. But there is this thing that I think has always happened with technology, which is that companies that have a lot of money and a lot of reach and a lot of developers and kind of move very quickly get validated in the market. They make more money, their valuations go up, and then people sort of stop looking at some of the maybe quality issues or ethical issues, and they kind of captivate and everyone kind of goes to them. I'd like to believe that part of the reason that the media and entertainment space hasn't fully embraced AI dubbing is, A, there's a lot of question marks about how do we integrate AI in particular, just like how do we integrate AI at a very high level? Two, quality, which media and entertainment companies have always been very precious about what quality stands for. And three, there's this ethical issue with that. So that's kind of the Paper Cup RWS approach. But I'm curious, from your standpoint as a startup, like, how are you kind of moving quickly, breaking things, as you know the adage goes? Like, where are you seeing sort of your biggest challenges as a startup trying to navigate this space in the media and entertainment space?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, when we started ADAPT, first it was like, just can we make it work? You know, like, let's grab Pro Tools, let's grab 11 Labs, let's grab, you know, Deep Dub, and let's mix it all together and see what we can push out the other end. And I think we were pleasantly surprised. Like, you know, that was the kind of, I remember, you know, downloading a clip off a platform, working with my CTO, Kevin Monroe, and dubbing our first German clip into English so that we could really say, is it good enough? And we were both like, wow, this is pretty good. Like, and you know, we're just hacking our way through it. So that's like, cool. Okay. There's theoretically a fit here. And then you start going down the path and start working with some customers and, you start, you know, getting into all of these potential issues. You know, quality. And I think that was the first one we really wanted to attack. You know, can we consistently do this for a long length of time and do it at scale? And the long length of time thing, I think, was the first one we were like, uh-oh. You know, I remember we did a test for an OTT platform early on and worked with them. This was a free POC stage of the company. And we did a full show, and Andre Scheidt, who's our director of production now, but was just doing some freelance stuff with us then, you know, basically didn't go to sleep for like 2 weeks straight just to try to get one episode done. And I think that was our first wake up that, like, there's a lot of crafting here with these AI voices, and B, there's kind of a burnout, like that you know, yes, it's kind of cool. Now I can go on with headsets and I can make these dubs all by myself. On the other hand, it's kind of lonely, you know, and you're in a dark room, you know, making these dubs all by yourself for 2 weeks straight. And so I think that was the first challenge we had to overcome. We got to do this faster. What are the tips and tricks to make this go faster? How do we do that? I think we figured that out. Scale was.
Can I ask you just before we get to the scale piece? Because I want to dig a little bit on this quality piece, which I find a real present. It's always present, I feel like, in our business, is this word quality. And, you know, I spent many, many years in the YouTube ecosystem and from really the beginning of YouTube. And it came up exactly in the, maybe not exactly in the same way, but in a similar way, right? So YouTubers start posting, you start getting this first wave of big YouTube creators. And inevitably, most traditional Hollywood folks, media and entertainment folks would say, that's not high quality. I mean, that's at first they called it user generated quality, right? UGC. And then they're like, oh, it's this creator stuff. Now a creator is getting millions of views, right? So to those people, you know, the argument from the creator side is, well, it's high quality. I mean, if millions of people are watching, watching my video, then to them it's high quality. Now the media and entertainment space goes, well, a lot of people eat McDonald's. That doesn't mean it's high quality, right? Yeah. And there's kind of this back and forth. Yeah. Are you more kind of like a traditionalist from a quality standpoint, where you go, hey, I think there is a absolutely you know, and there is an absolute with quality. It's not relative. It's not subjective. There's quality and then there's not quality. Or are you kind of like, no, if one person says they like it this way and another person says they like it this way, then that's quality. How are you? Because this in every conversation this comes up, you get 10 people look at the same thing and they all say something different.
Yeah, man. So I'd say yes, I'd like to say, I think there's room for some levels of tiering, though in order to tier, you really need to define what every level is. And in traditional dubbing, you could do that in some simple defined ways, right? You could do a lip sync dub where you're going to try to pick words in Spanish or German that match my lips that are moving now. You're going to try to adapt it. And you're also going to like strip out my original English audio and overlay me completely in German. So you had this lip sync dub. That was the hardest dub you could do in traditional dubbing, even today, right? And then you had a VO dub, a voiceover dub, which is more like, you know, you see like the, you know, President Macron speaking in France, and we're watching it here in America, and they duck his voice down, and then they just add like a very monotone English translation on top. And so with those definitions, I think you can do tiering. That said, I'm definitely a quality guy. I just like, if we're gonna do this, like if I'm gonna invest my like a chunk of my career in this journey, I'd like to look back on it and say people watch better dubs because, you know, Justin's little attempt to have an impact on this industry. And I think we do have, as like industry leaders, we have a responsibility to educate on why quality matters. But you're right, now there is like, we have to do it with data too. We can't just say, hey, I think we have to show it. Like, hey, this is a bad, this is a YouTube auto dub. And while I respect that it could fit somewhere, look at it. It's not as good as this adapt dub or, you know, paper cup dub or whatever. So A, I think we have to educate on it, but B, then we have to show the metrics that like, hey, viewership, yes, did fine with automated dubs, but did a lot better with a crafted AI dub, and maybe even, you know, did even better with a traditional dub. And that there's room for all three. So.
The word crafted, I think, is really important because that implies sort of there is some artistry to it or there's some crafting to it. And I think one of the things at RWS where we think a lot about is cultural, what we call cultural intelligence. So there's accuracy, like, okay, it's accurate. But is it really understood, and is it really culturally intelligent, right? And that to me is something, when people talk about machines versus humans, that's the hardest part, right? Is that you actually are taking a story and you're staying true to the creative vision, but also making it culturally relevant and nuanced in that language that you're dubbing it into. Like, this is something I think, I'm curious if you agree with me, that it's going to be very, very hard for the machines to get right, even in the long run.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the tech is incredible. The tech is really mind-blowing. But even when we use it in our personal lives, the better the prompt, the better the output. We all know that now. And I think, therefore, the better the prompter, the better the prompt, the better the output. And I think in this case, the prompter has to be a native speaker who's culturally aware of what's going on in that country, who can prompt better. And today, that prompting is on every line. You know, maybe tomorrow, that prompting is, you know, a well-written letter to the machine before the machine kicks it out. But that prompter and that prompting is important. And so I think, yes, you can mark me in the, I agree with Michael column, that cultural resonance will matter for a while.
And so, okay, 2 years in, you were a corporate guy for 20 years. You're 2 years into the startup journey. How's it going? Like, what is the you know, how are you liking it on a personal level? And what is it that will need to be true sort of in the world over the next few years for you to be successful?
Yeah.
And okay, I mean true, I mean like, yeah, what in AI? Yeah,
you have to answer the question. Then, how do you like it? Because
I will.
All right,
we'll trade with you. Okay.
Yeah, this is my second startup. First of all, so Sigma was my first one, and it only lasted a year, but it was only like 12 people, but it gave me enough of a bug that it's been in me ever since, and so I've been wanting to get back to it. I think the answer of how it's going is, you know, it's inspiring. It's awesome to be part of this moment that is happening. I think we can. If we do it right, we'll contribute to the quality matters and educate people why, and and that humans in the loop matter a lot, and but we have to put them in the right way. And so if I can succeed, those are things where I feel like, you know, you're going to sleep better at night. You're going to wake up and feel prouder in front of your 10-year-old kids. And so that's awesome. The caveat I'd say is it's harder to live the spreadsheet than it is to put the spreadsheet together. And I guess what I mean by that is when you put the spreadsheet together, you know, 2 years ago, when you're modeling out your business case and thinking about it, you're like, okay, yeah, okay, I'll take a reduced salary for 2 years, no salary for the first year, reduced salary for the second year. You know, we'll be unprofitable for a couple of years, but then, you know, it'll all be fine. And you're kind of like, yeah, 2 years, 3 years, no big deal. When you're actually in the second year of like, okay, I'm making a little bit of money, but nowhere near what I used to make. And, you know, therefore, you know, we're in the same old car, eating, you know, doing no vacations with the kids, you do, or like little weekend trips. It does, you know, that part of it kind of grinds on you. And I think when you're putting this sell sheet together, maybe you don't fully embrace the grind until you're in it. But I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't trade it. I would stay. I wouldn't undo the decision. I'm all in. Which then brings me to you. You've done this journey arguably successfully. You know, you've been able to be an entrepreneur in a lot of different ways a long time. Why RWS and why now?
It's a great, great question. So it's interesting, and this is not to throw the question back to you. It's really just to see if you agree with this, and I'm sure you do. There is a guy who actually went, he was a year below me in high school, named Adeo Resi. And he's pretty well known in the VC community. He's built VCs and he runs an institute around venture capital. And I saw an interview with him a few years ago. And the question was asked, how do startups fail? Or like, what is it that takes a startup to fail? And he said, there's only one reason startups fail. And the guy's like, oh, what could this be? So there's one reason. The founder gives up. And I thought that was really profound, because I think if you think about it as through a founder's lens, you know what that means at your core, that ultimately you find a way. If you own it, you find a way. Okay, you get turned down by 50 VCs. There's one last one you have, and then you get the money. You're struggling to get clients, and then finally you get that one client. You have a lot of people, then you're small, then you're big, then you're small, then you're big. You find a way to, no pun intended, adapt, and you make your way through. And so for me, you ask the question, why RWS? I was on a long journey with my startup Kin, which still exists, by the way. It's a studio business. We have a large library of content that is licensed in multiple places. But I found over the years, I'm curious if you've kind of have had the same experience, that part of the founder's journey is being able to look around corners and kind of make bets at what you think is around the corner. And in the media space and entertainment space, digital, I would call Kin a digital first studio. I felt like I was always able to do that. I was able to find like, okay, here's the MCN model. Okay, here's the now celebrities getting into YouTube. Or here's YouTube. Like literally, we were very early on YouTube being a platform, and then Instagram and Facebook and so on. And for whatever reason, kind of coming out of the pandemic, I just felt like I wasn't either able to see around the corner, or I wasn't inspired by what I was seeing around the corner. Maybe a perfect example of that today would be like micro dramas. God bless. I hope everyone makes a lot of money making micro drop. It just wasn't something that was really inspiring to me. And so I was lucky enough over the last 5, 6, 7 years to advise a bunch of startup companies. We talked about PaperCup being one of them. And so I just got more excited about working with that team and trying to solve some of those problems than trying to figure out how can I squeeze more pennies out of this video I've created and putting it on more platforms and gaming algorithms, or trying to like figure out what the algorithm wanted. We might be in the same place with AI, by the way. At the end of the day, we're constantly trying to figure out where is AI going. But for whatever reason, that became a much more exciting problem to solve. And I also kind of liked where RWS was in terms of their life cycle. Like, Ben's kind of come into the company and said, you know what, we're a 70-year-old localization company, but really we're going to skate to an AI puck. We're going to skate to figuring out how we integrate AI into our partners, and we're going to be the best AI enterprise company we can be, or AI solutions company we can be. That's going to be a multi-year process. It's going to take a lot of innovation. It's going to take a lot of energy. It's also a publicly traded company that has $1 billion in revenue a year and thousands of employees. And that just was new to me, probably similar to you, like the space that you're in is new and in some way invigorating, both on a kind of practical basis and on an intellectual basis. Is that fair to say from your standpoint?
I think so. You know, it resonates what you're talking about. I mean, I think one of the fun things about in your position coming to a company that you haven't worked at before is inspiration alone can change things, right? Like if you can take a bunch of smart people at RWS and say, look at this, like this is really cool and I'm inspired, and that just kind of bleeds down an organization, that in of itself can have an impact. Not to say you're just inspirational, but like I think you can hopefully play that mentorship role with our RWS in like a different way. Instead of one founder, you're working with thousands of people and saying, hey, what about this?
Yeah, the challenges are speed. Right. So I'm now at a big company. I was at a small company like Adapt for many, many years. And you can make decisions very quickly, and you can make changes very quickly, and you can make a left turn or a right turn or a hard stop. You can do all of those things. At a big company, it's not that quick. Now, I'm lucky that our group is sort of built off of a startup with Papercup, and we kind of startup and entrepreneurial minded, but it's not without its challenges, as I'm sure you know from your days working at big companies, right?
Yeah. You know, I think to me, the funnest part of joining, as chief operating officer at Deluxe, so it was an important role. It was, it was a small leadership team, but about 3,000 employees at the time that were in our division. And my favorite part of that journey, not to say I miss it, was finding the strength and muscle that already existed, like the DNA for certain things that worked. And at Deluxe, it was service. I mean, Deluxe knew how to service these legacy, media companies, and they were really, really good at it. And so then it would say, okay, with that foundation, how do you transform it? So I that'll be my one tip for you. You've given me a lot of tips over the year. It's like find that DNA, find what they're really good at, and then push them farther. Because there's no way that RWS became as big as they did without having something that they were really good at. And I think, how do you build on that?
For sure. So, okay, now let's get to some of the questions about the next couple of years with Adapt. Are you selling the company? This is not just a Justin Adapt question. This isn't any entrepreneur question. Yeah. Do you put more chips on the bet? Is the time now to consider partnering with a bigger company? Is the opportunity out there still 5 years, 10 years, 1 year? Give me the next couple of years. What's the magic wand solution for Justin and Adapt?
Yeah, that's fair. And maybe I'll take your offer to broaden that to the industry, because we're not alone, right? There are other, right. There are these big giants out there. RWS is one of them. Obviously, Transperfect is another. And then there are these little companies like Adapt that are saying, hey, there's something interesting going on. And I wish I could say we're the only one, but we're not, right? And so I think the question becomes, if I had to guess at the TAM of AI dubbing today, I would put it around like 20 million. Like it's a small industry, maybe 30, but pretty little. And if I had to take a guess at the TAM of media entertainment more broadly, dubbing, I'd put it at like 4 billion, right? So we are not even 1% converted from traditional dubbing to AI dubbing. And conversion is not even the right word, because theoretically people would dub more things they wouldn't have dubbed using AI, or localize more things they wouldn't have localized using AI. And I guess the reason I bring it up is we never got around to the scale thing with the challenge, like quality right. challenge. I think we've kind of figured out, we've hit a point that there's a product market fit to say AI dubbing is good enough for these use cases. Then the next question becomes, can we scale that up? Can we do it at scale? And I think this is where the acquisition question or partnering question comes into play. Is Adapt better off partnering with players that know how to scale? And I think that's probably, we will kind of decide that we have enough foundation. We've proven this out You know, we have 500 cultural ambassadors, we call them, that are our linguists. We have 500 cultural ambassadors. In order to go from 500 to 5,000, you know, does that change us so much that we're just better off partnering with a huge player to do that and deliver that? And I think that question will really drive when you sell, when you say it's better to join than to go it on your own. And I think this year will be our first test. Like, you know, we did probably about 10,000 minutes of AI dubbing last year. We think we'll do 100,000 this year.
That's 10x is pretty big. Yeah, that's big.
Like, you know, and we did most of our stuff in the fourth quarter, and it was painful. Like it was growth pain. It was like, oh my
god,
good. He's exhausted. Sure. You know, like the AI kind of works, but it broke down here, and the suddenly our AWS cost ballooned, and so I think this year is going to be very telling in how well we can do that on our own. So yeah, that's fun. I mean, that's exciting, right?
I think what you're describing though is probably a lot of the folks in the AI dubbing space who have been around for a long time. I mean, I still think there's money being invested. I heard, I probably shouldn't say who, because he told me in confidence, but someone in our space just raised $10 million more dollars. They're running an AI dubbing company. Yep. So there seems to be space, but it does, getting back to your curve or plateau, there does seem to be maybe a little bit of slowdown in investing in what I would say the middle of the AI dubbing space. So not the 11 labs they just raised last year, hundreds of millions of dollars and so forth, but kind of that next level. My guess is there's probably more consolidation in the space over the next year or two. I think there will be less players probably in that middle area of AI dubbing in a year or two, then there will be more. I could be wrong. You never know. But all right, I want to ask. Sort of, we're going to wind up in a few minutes here. But I want to ask a couple questions about media and entertainment companies. Yeah. So
a studio.
25 year vet of a media and entertainment company, big studio.
You're right.
And and you come in and you pitch, and why should I even take a risk? And I'll preface this by saying, and I'm curious if you agree with this. I think it's such a unique moment in time with media and entertainment, because let's put aside AI for 1 minute. We've been in a 25-year protracted disruption of the media and entertainment space, right? The internet and the very early days of streaming. So put even before YouTube, the Windows Media Players and Real Players, and then you have YouTube, and then you have the proliferation of streaming platforms. Like, media and entertainment world has been dealing with this massive disruption for 25 years. And now AI comes in as they're just dealing with the last 25 years of this. And now they've got to deal with that. So I say that just to say there's this kind of backdrop of having been in the washing machine for 25 years and dealing with disruption and dealing with, unfortunately, contraction and layoffs and fear and uncertainty. And so now we get to role play a little bit. I'm the 25-year grizzled veteran of a media and entertainment company. I've been dealing with all this stuff. Why am I even going to take a risk on AI dubbing?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to use, I'll call a friend here. I really like Evan Shapiro. He does some really good stuff on the media entertainment space. And I think Evan Shapiro, I went to his streaming TV, you know, conference, special kind of conference thing last year. And he was talking about the creator economy, and he was talking about legacy media, and he was like, it's not an either or, it's a yes and. And I thought that was just like, you know, such a silly little thing, but it really clicked for me, and it's been stuck in my head ever since. And I think it applies to AI dubbing too. And my advice to 25-year-old studio vet, maybe not wanting to do the innovation or is afraid that this will bleed is or have an impact on how the, it's not an either or, it's a yes and. Like, do the traditional in the language you've always done. And then
your dog has a point of view on this, for sure. I can tell.
Pomeranian wants to. She's like, wrong.
Sorry, I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to.
No. I'm glad. I'm glad you
finished. Please finish.
I should have put her in the little Chiron there. But it's not an either or. It's a yes and, right. And so I encourage studios to say, take that show, put it on YouTube, put it with an AI dub, see how it performs, then sell it to Netflix. You know, there is a conversion here of how content's being distributed and how it could be localized. And when we say distributed, the full extent of the world, like distributed to the globe. And I hope my passion, you know, bleeds into them a little bit, that like there is a yes and here. And if you play in localization with AI, that will teach you things about how to do localize and distribute the rest of your content. And so you should be really playing. You should be getting in there and figuring that out. And so that those are my words.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I think Genie's not going back in the bottle. AI is here. AI is getting used by everyone every day. And that ultimately media and entertainment companies, like every company in the world, is going to have to figure out how to be smarter, how to move quicker, how to be more efficient, how to integrate these tools. And if you don't, then you're more likely to get left behind at the end of the day. So I agree. I think being really, really attuned to what the needs are of these studios, and I know you've worked with studios most of your career, if not your whole career, the same with me, media and entertainment companies, listening, building trust. You know, I'd like for us not to always have to do POCs, as you and I both know, we're like in the POC world. Like, hopefully 2026 is the year we move beyond POCs, but probably not. It's probably going to be a while. And so I agree with you. I think it's not an either or, it's a yes and finding the right partners to partner with, trusting, building our community is going to be important. And I think building our community together, that's one thing I would love to see is companies like ours continue to kind of build at conferences and at events, and really kind of all boats will rise, I think, and people will have a little bit more trust in what we do because they see it not just as a little startup here or this company experimenting there, but it's really a community that you can trust. Okay. We have to do a speed round, and then we got to wrap it up. So you ready for the speed round here?
Let's do it. Speed round.
Okay. Do you agree or disagree with these statements? AI dubbing will be commoditized.
Disagree.
Okay. Quality differences will matter less than price over the next 3 years.
Disagree if we do what you and I are supposed to do. Yeah, disagree again.
Okay. Most localization vendors will become AI orchestrators.
Agree. If I have to pick one, I'll say agree. Yeah.
Okay. Fully synthetic voices will outperform human-led dubbing in 5 years.
No, I disagree. 5 years, I disagree. Maybe.
How many years? How many years?
I'll peg it at 12.
12, yeah. That's a nice arbitrary number.
Yeah.
Okay. Adapt sells in 2026.
I'll say disagree, but we'll see.
Okay, a lot of disagreement there. Well, any last questions for me before we wrap up, Justin? I don't know. Again, we can edit around this. So we covered a lot of ground here, which is awesome. And I think this is really, we could go on and on and on in so many different ways. Great, but
we could do that. Fine, either way. But okay, Michael, my question to you is, will Michael Wayne be at RWS in 5 years? Agree or disagree? I'll have to edit this one.
I mean, no. I would love to be at RWS in 5 years. I would speak for a lot of people at RWS. I think RWS has a very, very ambitious goal, but it's also not unlike Adapt in a very, very fluid market, and AI is changing so fast and businesses are changing so fast that RWS, like every company in the world, will need to be really, really good at execution. and it will be really, really good at, it needs to be really, really good at innovation. And you know, I sat on a panel years ago during COVID. It was like early COVID when VC was kind of drying up for folks. And I remember sitting on a panel with a VC and he said, you know what? The best VCs are unsentimental. And that also hit me. And I kind of feel like we have to, in many ways, as businesses, big and small, be unsentimental at this point and really look very hard at what works and what doesn't work and who is cut out to kind of be on this journey during this AI phase of business and who is not. And so I think Adapt and RWS and everyone else in our space need to be unsentimental about how quickly we make changes and how quickly we invest in things. And another buzzword is, you know, Jeff Bezos says high velocity decision-making. Mm-hmm. And I think companies now need to have higher velocity decision-making than ever before. And I think RWS is no different. So long-winded way. I know it was either agree or disagree. I'm good. Caveating it with, I would like to agree with it, but you know, it'll all come down to how well we as a company execute.
I love it. If you're there, you'll be inspired. So that's good. And that's a good, if you're there, then I'll know that you're inspired and there's something good going on. This was great, man. I could do this.
Yeah, this is fun. We could do it all day. Listen, Justin, I super appreciate you making the time. I look forward to working with you, over the next few years and beyond. And hopefully you'll come back on the pod and we can talk more about stuff.
I would love to. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.